Etta James, wow, what a voice. Born Jamesetta Hawkins, January 25th, 1938. We lost her back in 2012, early 2012. One of the great American treasures, Etta James, and that is Something's Got a Hold on Me. I'll tell you what's got a hold on me, talking about the future. Back to my conversation with James Canton in just a moment. Just a reminder, they're bringing me back tomorrow night, Sunday. I guess they'll keep bringing me back until I get it right, but I'll be joined by electrical engineer researcher Jim Elvidge. He'll talk about the nature of our reality, presenting a theory so perfect that it explains what life and reality are all about, what matter is, what happens after we die, and why our universe appears finely tuned. And in the first hour, get this, a teenage girl spent 3 years of her life convinced she was dead due to a rare medical condition known as walking corpse syndrome. Harvard-trained psychiatrist Peter Bregan we'll discuss this disease, which is also known as Cotard's syndrome, and how it can be overcome. That's Sunday on Coast to Coast, and yours truly in the air chair. We'll talk more with James Canton in a moment, just including regenerative medicine and how it will predict and prevent illness, rebuild brains and bodies, and extend the human lifespan up to 150 years. Smart machines, he says, will design, manage, and service 40% of all global businesses by 2025. Expect energy, commerce, finance, and manufacturing without humans. Avatars will be the front end of a massive cloud-based AI capacity with access to real-time knowledge over the internet. They'll speak over 100 languages and can teach any subject with the expertise of a master. I'll also ask James Canton, what is the future of healthcare? What's next after the 3D printing and manufacturing? What's the future of space travel? Can nanotechnology heal the planet? And wither the nation state? All that and more when my conversation with futurist James Canton continues here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. And welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett with you, along with James Canton, PhD, futurist, and the author of Future Smart. And I've opened up a hashtag, if you want to tweet. We will open the phone lines up at the bottom of the hour for your questions and comments. But the hashtag is hashtag RichardC2C, as in Coast to Coast, hashtag RichardC2C. And let me share a couple of these with you, James. One here is from Cabe Verforden. Cabe Verforden, hashtag I teach online. I started with computer-based teaching in 2006. It was great. In the last few years, it is so full of glitches, it's almost impossible to use. I spend more time reteaching now than I did 5 years ago. First, you have to harden the system, then outsmart the hackers. What do you think about that, James?
Well, this is the beginning of trying to get some standardization around this technology. There's a little company that I know called Alva, EDU, that has developed a product called CourseFlow, and there's many of them. That's just one that comes to mind. So we're still kind of in the early stages of creating an online platform that is, let's say, versatile enough and agile enough that teachers and students can connect online. My brother is a professor of film, and he manages virtual students around the world at his institution, which is Full Sail. And you know, at the end of the day, this technology is evolving. It's not all perfect yet. This is kind of the beginning of almost like the computer era when it comes to online learning. We still haven't got the kinks out. There's still lots of innovations that are coming. The internet is not as robust as it should be, but I'm betting that very shortly here, in near term, the demand for agile courseware will, and meaning that people continue, whether it's the baby boomers, or the Gen Xers, or the millennials, they're going to need to get retooled, reskilled. That's going to become part of their lifestyle in learning new things. And I think online education will lead that, and there'll be lots of new breakthroughs and innovations. And I would encourage anybody who is teaching to be part of kind of shaping the tools that they want.
Do you see this as the great leveler, you know, that's going to bridge the gap between the haves and the have-nots? This, let's say, for example, free online university education. Is that coming down the pipe?
Oh, it's already here. You can go online, and you can participate in MOOCs and Udiversity. There's 5 or 6 different courses. There's Khan Academy. You can learn all kinds of things. You can get certified. You can get alternative degrees now. Even major universities, I would forecast that over 65 to 75% of all mainstream universities over the next 36 months will be offering an online course. Soon, you will be able to go online and get your degree from Harvard or even MIT. I mean, MIT received funding over 5 years ago to give away their bachelor's. Imagine that. The MIT, one of the leading, if not the leading, technical university, which is almost impossible to get into unless you're really brilliant, they give away their bachelor's, which is all of their courses, all of their videos, all their curriculum. They give it away online. It has spawned a free giveaway of knowledge. You have entirely new learning systems that have been built on the free BA bachelor's that MIT has given away. You're going to see a lot more of that emerge.
When President Obama announced at his most recent State of the Union address that he'd like to see community college given away for free, and a lot of people predictably sort of balked at that and said, well, how are we going to pay for this? That doesn't seem to be too far afield from what you're saying. Is he on the right track?
Oh, I absolutely. I think the president's on the right track. I think, there's been a number of innovations. So when Jeb Bush was governor of Florida, he gave away 4 years if you maintained a B. If you had good marks in high school, you got to go to a public university in Florida. And that was brilliant. Imagine every governor deciding that they were going to find the monies, a portion of the state money, a portion of the federal money, to make available, a BA, 4 years, not just 2 years. I think we should be doing that. I think college has gotten way too expensive. I mean, we owe $1 trillion in student loans today. When I got my doctorate, it cost me less than $50,000 to get my PhD for 4 years, and I worked part-time. Today, that it's very difficult to get a doctorate under $100,000. I mean, most of the kids getting out of school today have spent 2 or 3 times that for a graduate degree. We've got to transform education. It's not just about the cost. It's about making it relevant and looking forward as opposed to looking backward. We need to be educating kids to be future smart. Teach them about being entrepreneurs, science and technology. We need to be teaching for the careers that are coming, not just the careers that have been popular in the past.
Are technological advances and developments, are they going to be able to solve many of the short, the budget shortfalls that we have? We you talked about student debt. We have the student debt bubble. We have the credit card bubble, credit card debt. We have, Medicare, Social Security, all these unfunded liabilities that, according to some estimates, the United States' real debt is something on the order of $200 trillion. Can that be solved through technology?
Well, let me put things in perspective. Great question. So 1/3 of our GDP, which is the measure of growth, is technology-driven industries today. Okay. My forecast is over the next 5 to 10 years, that will creep up to becoming 2/3. So clearly the uptrend, the impact of technology in creating growth, in creating affluence, in creating a robust economy has been successful in the United States and will continue to grow, meaning the United States is the largest economy still in the world, and it is not the fastest growing, but it is the most robust. And I think that technology will continue to play a very important role. Advanced technologies, technologies that haven't even gotten out of the gate yet. I mean, how many people really have products and services that have been influenced by neurotechnology or nanotechnology or quantum technology? I mean, most of us are using a fraction of the power of our computers today. Most of us think it's all about email and YouTube and the internet. It's about, you know, algorithms. We should be teaching our kids starting in grammar school how to program. We should be teaching physics in kindergarten. When my kids were in school up to recently, I would teach a program at their school, physics for kids, and start in kindergarten. You know, if you go into Chinese classrooms, which I have, they're teaching kids in the early grades, middle school, robotics. They're teaching kids in third, fourth grade, English. How many kids and how many PTAs are fighting over making sure that robotics and language skills are in every curriculum, whether it's in Des Plaines, Illinois, or it's, you know, around the world? We need to be transforming the education system to be future smart. It's not. And technology is a critical part of that. We need to be bridging this gap between the startup economy, the science and technology labs, the research and development, and our schools, because that's where the jobs are going to come from. And so when you ask a question about technology, it's about the comprehensive use of technology to create the next jobs, the next competitive advantage of the United States, the next economies that will transform the world based on these five technologies that I keep mentioning: nanobio, neuro, quantum, and IT.
To be quite frank, a techno peasant. I'm doing my best to keep up, but it's hard at this stage. However, I went into a department store at Christmas and I saw my first 3D printer for sale. And I've been hearing a lot about 3D printers and how they are, they have the potential to be this disruptive technology, and they're going to level the playing field in terms of, let's say, China and Mexico's comparative advantage in terms of manufacturing. I don't know. I don't get the sense we're seeing that yet. Where are we with 3D printers, and what is the potential of these 3D printers? Some have said that this could be bigger than the Industrial Revolution.
Well, I think that we're at the early stages. This is like when I was at Apple in 1984. This is early in the game. So this is 3D printing is in its infancy. Now, I just heard reported in a research study I just examined not even 36 hours ago, just to give you an idea how fast this is moving, 3D printing, about a company now that has a high-yield, very cost-effective 3D printer that prints electronics, prints circuit boards. And I want our listeners to appreciate the implications of this. Remember what I said earlier, the next 10 years are going to be like the past, really, 100,000 years. So you're going to have accelerated exponential technologies. So you're going to see 3D printing, though it's very early today. The next 3 to 5 years are going to be almost like 100 years between 84 and, 2004. We're talking about very accelerated, faster than Moore's law technology. So you're going to have the ability, everybody will have a 3D printer in their home, number one. Every business will have a 3D printer. Today, the military is using 3D printers to build a variety of aircraft. Boeing, the biggest aircraft companies, are using 3D printers to be able to do rapid, real-time deployment. So we're talking about technology that will be making pharmaceuticals, that will be making industrial products, consumer products, that will be making clothing. And eventually, the most exciting one will be 3D printing that will be used with the same kind of printing technology that's in your printer in your business today or in your home today. That same technology will be printing organs and medical devices that are personalized and configured for you.
Wow. Will we be producing, what about Big Pharma? Will it become personalized? Will we be producing our own drugs that are sort of directly, that are smart drugs, that they know our DNA, they know how to target specific parts of our body and so forth? Will we be producing those in our own home?
I believe we will. It'll come in a couple of different stages. So this is somewhat early for that, right? But I could see 3D printers that are tied through the cloud, cloud computing, to wireless networks that are tied to genomics, DNA sequencing. So imagine this, you upload your DNA sequence information, and it analyzes your particular kind of anemia that you have, right? And it determines that your anemia would be helped by this new kind of drug that gets programmed from your pharmaceutical provider through the cloud computer, directly wirelessly programmed into your 3D printer that sits just like you have a printer in your home or your business today. There's not much more technology than you'd need to be able to print out a particular kind of pharmaceutical, okay? That pharmaceutical, based on your DNA, based on the particular disease that you have, or to, more importantly, prevent that disease, okay? That's where all of this is going. We have a tremendous burden. Every government on the planet has a tremendous burden to keep their citizens healthy. Every pharmaceutical company, every healthcare organization has a burden. We're spending alone on Alzheimer's alone over $30 billion in lost productivity in this economy. Imagine being able to prevent one or two diseases, which we imagine preventing. We may not be able to prevent all diseases, but we could start to prevent cardiovascular disease, diabetes. If we could just prevent 1% a year exponentially every year, and add to that exponentially another percent every year, we could be saving billions of dollars in our economy. Quality of life would increase. People could be living vastly longer, healthier, more productive, prosperous lives. That's where all this is going. You got to look forward and say, okay, Dr. Kent, where does it look in Future Smart? I mapped this out. Within 5 to 10 years, personalized pharmaceuticals based on not just 3Ds, but other kinds of personalized synthetic biology, new kinds of pharmaceuticals, big push on medical devices that will be very, very dynamically designed for you, will be keeping us living longer, healthier, and more productive.
Again, coming up on a break, and I'll throw this out, this log on the fire, and then we'll pursue it after. Nanotechnology, great promise we're hearing about nanotechnology in terms of surgery and so forth. But I'm looking at surgery on the planet. We hear about this huge island of plastic that's floating out in the ocean that's the size of Australia or something, or the size of Texas. Does nanotechnology have the potential to heal the planet, to repair, let's say, for example, the ozone or the atmosphere, or to ameliorate climate change, or to get rid of this huge plastic island?
Well, I believe that it does. It's at the earliest stages, but again, nanotechnology, when it converges with information technology, wireless networks, converges with sensors. In other words, the ability to have embedded intelligence. In other words, to have let's say you want to dissolve this plastic island, some of it's the size of, growing the size of massive football fields, if not small states. You would be able to use nanotechnology to manipulate matter to create and dissolve this plastic so it then becomes, organically assimilated into H2O. In other words, it becomes...
Okay, let's pursue that, pick that up on the other side, Dr. Canton. Thank you. Dr. John takes us into the break with Ico. Coast to Coast AM, Richard Serrett, back with more in a moment. And that's the Fab Four, the Beatles, coming back with one of their lesser-known songs, Rain, a beautiful song, but we don't hear that too often. You know, the future is sounding pretty rosy in our conversation with James Canton, PhD, futurist, and author of Future Smart. Many of our current problems, it would seem, hunger, pollution, energy, socioeconomic inequities, disease, they all seem to be solvable through technological advances. But what's the downside? What sort of technology, for example, will intelligence gatherers and government agencies in the future have at their disposal that could be used to invade our privacy? What sorts of technology will our enemies have at their disposal? How will wars be fought in the future? We'll get into all of that, plus your phone calls for Dr. James Canton, futurist, here on Coast to Coast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett with you, along with James Canton, PhD, futurist, and the book is Future Smart. Before the break, James, we were talking about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, and I had to sort of cut you short there. I wanted you to finish that thought about the promise of nanotechnology to heal the planet and maybe to address ecological disasters like this garbage patch.
Well, for every challenge that faces us, the grand challenges that face our world, whether it's dealing with pollution such as the island of one of many of garbage, floating garbage islands out there, or it's dealing with, you know, solar exposure because of ozone, or dealing with a changing climate. I believe that there are technological fixes that are available. Again, you know, I'm a futurist that has to look pragmatically at we have developed and we are developing in these advanced technologies, nanobio, neuro, IT, but some of these we're not moving fast enough on to keep pace, for instance, with climate change. So is it theoretically possible to dissolve plastic and neutralize it, neutralize a island of floating garbage? Yes, there is. Are there efforts that are being, with dollars and research that are being put into that, developing that technology? Not enough. Are there large-scale, multi-billion-dollar geoengineering projects that are being developed to be able to stave off climate change that are being put into play? And the answer is not enough. There is not the bold, big, let's say, experiments that led to putting a man into space, even inventing nanotechnology was something that started off with President Clinton and then was picked up by President Bush, where we put billions of dollars, and we still put billions of dollars, and we catalyzed a world, you know, revolution in creating a new material science, such as nanoscience. What I'm trying to say is that it's not too late, but we need to be putting more investment in R&D into creating that next generation of nanotechnology to deal with, or next generation of geoengineering to deal with climate change and pollution. And I don't see the bucks that are being invested there. I see the possibilities. I don't see the investment yet. And I'm calling for that in my book, Future Smart.
You mentioned putting a man on the moon, and I want to talk about the future of space travel and colonization in a moment. But let's get to the calls on the wild card line. Scott is checking in from right here in my backyard, Toronto. Scott, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. As I was listening, I heard a very optimistic doctor up until about the last minute there, and that's why I called in. I have to inject a little bit of pessimism into this optimistic discussion, because as a young boy and a young man, I used to read Omni magazine and dream of the future and be a sort of a futurist myself. What I see now in this world is powers that be dumbing down society, people who don't want advancements, people who stifle technology, stifle research and development, and the name of wars and other disgusting things that are happening on the planet. Personally, I believe we should have been off world by now. either terraforming or building stations on the moon or maybe Mars or in space. But what I see is more money being forced into research and development of weapons, for example. I don't see people that want to find a cure for cancer. I'm convinced that there are, absolutely are, cures for so-called incurable diseases. I see a world that is being stifled, and we are being stopped. And I wonder if the doctor can address that, and I'll listen off air. Thank you.
Great call, Scott. Thank you.
Well,
James?
Yeah, as I said earlier, there's a double-edged sword. This is my third book, and in every single one of my books, going back to 1995, I have pointed out that technologies, one, have been developed and not made it into the marketplace, sometimes for years. Even technologies we thought that were going to heal or make a difference in terms of productivity or development. Do I think that there's a vast government or governments or private sector conspiracy to make money at the expense of citizens, or to hold back strategic technologies that could lead to a revolution in learning or communications or even end certain diseases? I don't. I think that people take for granted there's a difference between science fiction and science fact. And though I'd love to be able to, and I read Omni magazine certainly too, and I work with some of the leading futurists in the world, and I get to see a lot of things in labs that are not quite ready for prime time. I think people underestimate how much effort it takes to not just invent something, but then move it into the marketplace and have it get adopted. And I do believe that this is a unique time, but you know, for all intents and purposes, for every single technology I'm talking about today, though I am an advocate for using them for delivering benefits, every single one of them can be used to curtail democracy, to restrict or take societies down into even, you know, coercion and enslavement. You just have to look around the world today to see where the free societies are or where they're not, and many technologies are not allowed. You can directly look around the world and see, you know, where technologies, let's take the internet alone, where the internet is, where you're able to get access to the internet, and where free speech is and where democracy is, and see where the largest, most productive countries are in terms of quality of life. It's not hard to figure all that out. I believe it's in our interest to bring advanced technologies into the marketplace, and I don't think you can keep it. You can't. If there's an innovation around energy or healthcare or some degree of science that will create a breakthrough, I believe eventually it will come into the marketplace and it will therefore be available. I'm a great believer that you can't hide it.
Sort of following along with Scott's sort of pessimistic vein here, and let me ask you about what concerns you in terms of technology that might be at the disposal of Intel. We heard a lot about encryption devices and tracking devices from Snowden, about the NSA and so forth. I guess, in a nutshell, what is the future of privacy?
Well, I believe the future of privacy will be based on where you are on the planet. In most European countries, and increasingly in North America and South America, you're videotaped, you're captured on video over 500 times a day if you walk through any kind of a city. I believe that privacy, the trade-off between privacy and security is such that with more terrorists, criminal invasions of our privacy from rogue actors, we will inevitably, it'll eat into our privacy. I don't believe there is the future of privacy is going to be without strong protections for democracy and liberty, particularly mandated by government. And there are individual technologies that are very fast being developed to create more anonymous surfing of the internet which you can do today. But I believe that, you know, it is not a rosy story moving forward in terms of identity theft and cybersecurity. Every day, what you hear about is just a small portion of the hacks, invasions, and identity thefts that will continue. We are not innovating as fast in the area of privacy, and we haven't even gotten to the real problems that are coming. When your genome is then used as a secure identifier, when every government, insurance company, employer has access to your DNA as a identifier, when DNA profiling becomes, in many parts of the world, the way you will get a job or you will do a deal or what school you will get into, people won't find that to be a happy scenario. So not all of my forecasts in my book, Future Smart, are ones that you can sleep at night with.
All right. Mark is calling east of the Rockies from Waldorf, Maryland. Good morning, Mark. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Morning. I'd like to ask the guest, what specific long-term investments would he favor, whether it be stocks or index funds, in the five areas you mentioned, nano, bio, quantum, IT, and neural?
Well, I'm not a professional stock picker, and I'm asked this question a lot. So, you know, I like index funds, I like individual companies. The ones that are, I believe that you have to do your own kind of homework. I'm not in the business of recommending stocks, but I can say that the technology sector will continue to outperform the fusion of business and advanced technologies, particularly around healthcare, particularly around social media and internet businesses. You know, where companies that are public are creating new disruptive platforms. And, you know, the existing ones that are there today, I mean, you think about Google completely disrupting advertising. When you think about Facebook completely dominating the desktop, where Microsoft didn't understand that, you know, you think about what are the next disruptive business models that are out there. I'll leave it to you to do the picking. I do like the index funds regarding energy and technology, though. I do think that those are uptrends, but I'll leave it to more astute stock market pickers to select those particular companies and equities.
All right, Mark, thanks for the call. Wildcard line, Brandon is in State College, Pennsylvania. Brandon, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. What's up?
Glad to have you aboard. Your question for Dr. Canton.
Yeah, you guys, I kind of turned the radio on, right? Talking about the 3D printers and whatnot. And, you know, then you guys just started to talk about space travel. I was just wondering, you know, if they were ever to, what would be the technology? Do they have the technology to say, like, they want to go to Mars or they have a station somewhere? Would they have printers that would be able to say there'd be, like, a damage to the ship? Would they be able to print out a part to fix it or anything like that of that nature?
Imagine if they had that on Apollo 13. Problem solved.
Problem solved, exactly. The answer is yes. This technology is moving very fast. Think about it. You know, the 3D printer, it's not that different from the printer technology that sits on your desk today. The technology that it's used, the industrial level technology for 3D printing that currently is in use, will be on every spaceship, if you will, every space colony, every orbiting structure, and it will be integrated into it. So think about autonomous artificial intelligence that will be able to, you know, predict the exact precision of either a pharmaceutical or a fabric or even a complex device. You know, let's say the equivalent of a carburetor, you know, or a particular complex device that's useful for telemetry or guidance breaks down, that program will be able to replicate that complex device in a spaceship or in a colony to be able to replace it. You won't need to bring, in other words, your library of algorithms and programs will be more valuable than an extra device or two. And yes, it will be available to all of them. And the more complex devices that will be used on Mars, and Mars is something that is, you know, in our lifetimes we'll see incursions to Mars. The terraforming, there will be 3D type technology that will be used to terraform parts of Mars before we even get to Mars. And they'll be set up there. Think about it as automated robotics. You know, it's where robotics, 3D printing, and synthetic biology and nanotechnology all converge in creating a new kind of, you know, post-knowledge-based industrial ecosystem, not just on our planet, but on other planets that we're looking to habitat.
Is there a fast track to terraforming a planet like Mars? I mean, I would think something like that would take hundreds of years. Is there a fast track?
Well, if you look at the advances in a new area of technology called synthetic biology. Synthetic biology is really a combination of biochemistry, really engineering, you know, folks that like to make things with the harnessing the engines of biology. You know, biology and is our notion of the brain and what nature has delivered in organic systems is more complex than anything humans can make. So synthetic biology kind of harnesses the use of biomimetics, you know, these engines of nature, and imagine being able to harness these engines and create programs that will create synthetic DNA and synthetic organisms. Now, let's say you program how you want to, you know, terraform or engineer an atmosphere. And now that's very grand. That's a big, bold vision. And you send those synthetic biological programmed organisms in a delivery to Mars, and you then terraform them for 10 years. You could then create structures. You could create micro atmospheres inside of structures that self-inflate on Mars that will be ready for 2025, 2030 when we bring humans into Mars. That's the way we're going to be thinking about all of this. So technologies that can be programmed, can be, you know, can deliver a payload to, let's say, Mars, are being conceptualized now. So there'll be advanced programs, advanced robotic deliveries made to set up environments, these microenvironments, that will be ready to sustain humans and, of course, other kinds of cybernetic and robotic inhabitants.
I was reading an interesting blog post recently, which has sort of sparked conversation about an old but still compelling plan to build floating cities above the surface of Venus. In other words, what you could do is you could take a balloon filled with air, which could float on Venus's carbon dioxide atmosphere. And while you can't land humans on the surface of Venus, you could float above it in relative cities, so, or in relative safety. So the idea is that we would live in the clouds above Venus. What do you think of that?
Well, let me give you the stages of development over the next 25, 30 years. Before we get to Venus, so here are the steps. Phase one will be a capability to leave the planet and to set up orbital structures that will be orbiting the Earth. Right now, we haven't done that. We need to do that. That will occur over the next 3 to 5 years. You look for companies like SpaceX, you know, Elon Musk is going to lead this. The best thing that's happened to the development of space is really what's happened with SpaceX.
I agree. Let's just hold on that thought, and we'll pick this up on the other side. James Canton, my guest, futurist, as we talk about how to get future smart. Cyndi Lauper, All Through the Night, taking us into the break here on Coast to Coast. Stay with us.